within the limit of, you know, its range. But that's not the capability of the fiber. The fiber is capable of much more. So what you do is you use different light frequencies for different services, and you can really have one heck of a lot of bandwidth. You were talking about 40 gigabits. You know, I mean, I got a gigabit Ethernet line between here and Syracuse, New York. And that's only one light frequency. And with a bunch of other light frequencies, we do a lot more stuff. So the capability to do a lot of different things is there. Your BIOS, for example, is WDM, whereas at the phone service and the internet service, are completely different wavelengths. K2RW, K2JET. The actual wavelengths going over that fiber, Eric, I'm guessing some of it's near infrared, medium infrared, and optical. I'm going to guess that they're not using very much ultraviolet. Are these the approximate the wavelength slash frequency regions of the information going down that cable? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet? Rather than listed in nanometers, let's just talk about color of light. So, you know, there's stuff that runs from red to green. I've never seen anything that's blue, but they're getting there. So, are you saying the majority of information is in the optical red to green? None of it's near infrared? I thought some of our early lasers and our early cables were very efficient in the near infrared frequencies, like
that's very true.
Like 1,000 nanometers. Over to you, Eric. Yeah, they still use, you know, they're still lower than 600 nanometers in some cases. But the emphasis in terms of technology is not so much making infrared emitters. It tends to be more in the visible light region. But yeah, it depends upon the type of service. Like the phone company uses stuff that's near infrared, or actually infrared. But today's technology has expanded the bandwidth capabilities, and they're going utilizing more of the light space, and also the efficiency of fiber itself in terms of where the tomb, so to speak, has moved up from the early days. Eric, you are an RF person primarily with a lot of optical experience. You talked about 600 nanometers, and sometimes they're using lower than 600 nanometers. When you say lower...
That's higher, sorry.
That's what I was about to say. Lower means lower in frequency, which means longer wavelengths. It's very similar to if somebody tells you to turn down the air conditioning. When you turn down the air conditioning, does the house get warmer or colder? Over to you, Eric.
You know, that entirely depends upon what country you live in. When we say turn it down, it means make it warmer. And you know, when they say turn it down, make it colder. So, you know, whatever, however you want to interpret it. But no, sorry, I meant longer wavelengths, you know, lower frequency.
Yeah, we don't have a frequency counter operating at the optical wavelengths yet. That's the reason why we still call it 550 nanometers is the middle of the optical band. We talk about wavelength. Just like in the old days, a particular ham band was called a 20-meter ham band. You didn't have a frequency counter that could count 14 megahertz. Therefore, you discussed wavelength, and wavelength is what you measured on your slotted line or your electrowire system. And that's also how you measured standing wave ratio.
We have a device that you plug the cable in, and it tells you what frequency it is, but it does it by spectroscopy. I can't say it.
Yeah, I'm guessing there's no real frequency counter directly counting cycles yet at optical frequencies. I don't think frequency counters that go much beyond, I'm going to pick a number, 100 gigahertz. Even there, I think they've got a front-end down converter bringing it down to an IF that really gets counted in a crystal oscillator front-end. Here's a question for you, Eric. Of the cables that are now in service, what do you believe is the longest wavelength, the lowest frequency, the cable
missile is capable of carrying. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
As far as I know, they passed, low infrared. I forget where they end, but yeah, it goes, and they also go up into UV. So, I mean, the capability is there, but the response is different at different frequencies, you're aware of that.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an insertion curve of dBs per kilometer versus wavelength / frequency. And my guess is the currently available cables are a little bit more lossy of that ultraviolet frequencies, and therefore the ultraviolet for long range are not as likely to be used. That cable system you got that goes up to Albany, Schenectady, Rochester, wherever, it's probably using one of the wavelengths where the cable has the minimum loss. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, it's actually a range. It's in, I don't remember whether it's in thousands of megahertz or hundreds of megahertz, where the attenuation is hard to measure. But, you know, it all depends upon the chemistry of the glass, how the glass is made, and that's why there's different kinds of fiber. It's not just one kind of fiber. I mean, dozens of different kinds of fiber for different types of applications. There's also single mode, multi-mode, all sorts of weird things that we don't even think about in the RF world.
When they speak of multi-mode cable, I think what they're really saying is it's going to carry multiple wavelengths in a single mode manner for each wavelength. If you really had multiple waves, multiple modes going down the cable at one particular wavelength, the interferometry, the difference in velocity factor of those two different modes, with a good long length of cable, I think that would give a lot of inter-symbol distortion. Isn't that true, Eric? K2LIW.
Well, as I said before, you run into these problems of group delay, and a few other factors that enter into it. But the one thing that you got to say for glass, for something that's manufactured for a specific frequency or a specific group of frequencies, is that if you put that up against a piece of coax, it's like, you know, a difference in 100 years of technology. You know, it's the point of how good does good have to be? K2LIW, K2J.
AC2IS, info.
Bill recognized. You guys that are listening to my voice right now didn't live through a particular episode of Bell Laboratories, which was considered the most advanced research laboratory in roughly 1970. They were putting a huge amount of effort into a 2-inch diameter pipe that with RF frequencies was going to carry, I think they said, 250,000 telephone conversations simultaneously in this 2-inch diameter pipe using the TE01 mode of waveguide transmission, which was considered very low loss of, I don't know what the number was, it was probably 2 dB per kilometer. And that pipe, that 2-inch diameter pipe, had to have extreme precision in its straightness in the way it was installed in the ground. That was going to be a heroic effort. And very soon, fiber optics came along. And where the fiber optics really came from is one hell of a question. There are people who think... Let me drop this. There are people who seriously think that there's a company in the Dayton, Ohio area, can't think of the name of the company right now, high-class, high-tech company, that was given the task of reverse engineering the hardware that had been recovered from the crash site in Arizona. Why can't I think of the name of the place all of a sudden? What's the name of the place in Arizona where Roswell, New Mexico, is what I'm trying to say. Roswell, New Mexico. There are people who believe that this company in Ohio, reverse engineering the Roswell hardware, is where we suddenly realize that fiber optics has got a huge advantage of all kinds.
Area 52.
And so, okay, we've got people lined up who are going to ask some further questions. Bill first. AC2IS, K2RW, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, well, don't tell that to the folks in Corning.
I hear you. Go ahead, Bill.
Area 62.
This is ACTIS, and yes, my understanding is this technology came out of Corning's labs. In regard to multimode fiber, the way that works is by having two different glass materials with a different index of refraction. And maybe you guys have heard of, I don't know if you'd call it an experiment, but the observation that with refraction, when light enters water, you know, the angle that the light is traveling in changes direction. And the same thing occurs with light leaving the water. Say the light leaving the water, beam of light leaving the water, the beam would become more shallow, would be more parallel to the surface of the water. And if the beam is already very parallel to the surface of the water when it hits that surface, assuming you have a perfectly flat surface of the water, the beam is refracted back in. And so what happens is that the beam of light will stay inside that one piece of fiber with the higher index of refraction, and the wrapping around it, another piece of glass with another index of refraction, should not have the light in it at all. That being said, there is still more intersymbol distortion, etc., with multimode fiber as opposed to single mode fiber, despite the fact that with single mode fiber, there's a continuous change in index of refraction so that the light will pass through many different indexes of refraction. It's supposed to be a continuous gradient from the center of the cable towards the perimeter. AC2IS.
Yeah, something to that.
Yeah, graded index of refraction is a very desirable characteristic if you want only a single mode. It turns out the lens of a human eye is a graded index of refraction optical device. Go ahead, Eric.
Judge is a real-world example of what we're talking about here. When you splice a piece of fiber, you know, for many years it's been a really difficult process to create a perfectly flat surface that's going to mate to the next piece of fiber. And you'd be surprised how many problems are introduced by somebody not putting enough elbow grease into making that fitting. Today it's a different story. We've actually got fixtures now and devices where essentially it's an automated microscope that does the creation of the surface ending. There's these new terminations which actually have these flat windows on them. That's all done mechanized, and all the problems of the refractions that would come about making that made have pretty much gone these days. So the world has improved as technology moves along. KQRW, K2J.
When you're splicing two pieces of cable, I'm going to guess that each cut piece is at, I'm going to pick a number, a 45-degree angle, made optically smooth, very coherent. You got a pair of matched optical surfaces you're bringing together. Do you then hold them together with external mechanical devices like glue, or do you actually fuse that glass itself by melting that junction? What really happens at that splice to permanently put those two pieces together, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Alright, now, that what you're describing is a really cool idea, but that's not the way we do things. Let's take a today's way of making a splice between two pieces of glass. If it's, let's say you've got a break in the cable and you're going to reconnect the cable. There, the device actually melts and fuses the glass together. That's one method, okay? Now, let's say you have a patch cord where you need to be able to move light from one place, from one hole, and it's going to go into a different hole. There, the surface plane of the glass is perpendicular to the glass itself. So you're putting a flat surface next to a flat surface. So the idea of cutting it 45 degrees, if you had a device that
translate that into a flat surface, that would work for a patch cord. That definitely won't work for a patch cord, though. So, the things that I've seen is, you know, it's 90 degrees. The surface is 90 degrees of the, you know, perpendicular to the length of the cable.
Okay, Bill recognized. Now, some of these glasses have got exotic design, Eric, in radial cross-section with this graded index of refraction and one kind of glass with the inner diameter, another glass with the outer diameter. If you're now going to splice that complicated design graded index of refraction glass, how in the world do you maintain those characteristics at that junction where you have just remelted it? Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
I didn't catch all of that, Dick. I'm sorry.
Some of the very high performance optical fibers have an inner cable with a graded index of refraction that ensures you've got a single mode. You might have a cladding of another kind of glass on the outside of the inner piece of glass and some kind of protection around that. If you're going to melt that junction in order to create a splice, how do you maintain all of that graded index of refraction at the place where you just melted it? Aren't you going to get an impedance bump in that area? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
All right, KQRIW, KE2EJ. I don't know if you've ever played with a piece of fiber, but it's one solid piece of drawn glass that is covered by a jacket. I mean, essentially, when you put it into the machine that's going to do it, and it does it optically, by the way, you don't have the jacket. You don't have actually that raw piece of glass fiber, and you're talking about the same type of fiber connecting to the same type of fiber, so it's the same chemistry. And yes, you actually do get a little bump that you can see with a TDR, but anything that you pass through a fiber these days has either FEC or trellis or some form of error correction when we're talking about data. When we're talking about doing a cable system and passing RF, those things are inherent in transmission, and it's the method of transmission, like the cable, it's QAM, is almost invisible to the signal. So that's another one of the reasons why QAM likes fiber and fiber likes QAM.
So it's done in an automatic way, done very carefully, and you get an extremely small impedance bump you could see with a time domain reflectometer. And I guess you can't make that bump go to zero. Therefore, you need some of these error correcting techniques. AC2IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
AC2JAS, checking in.
Yeah, this is Bill, AC2IS, and yeah, like Eric said, when you do fusion splicing with fiber, every fusion splicer that I'm aware of cuts the cable straight, and so you have a butt-end join when they're fused together. And yeah, I believe that the interface is detectable with a time domain reflectometer, and that when you have that interface, you get some apparent loss on the far end that comes from some partial reflection back. I think generally the reflection back towards the laser that's transmitting does not really affect the transmitting laser, and effectively you're probably just getting some fraction of a dB of loss at that fusion splice. And like Eric said, with patch cords, typically those are butt ends or polished ends as well. I've never seen it, but there is an angle polished connector that used to be used with video. I'm not sure if there are modern applications for it. But the purpose, supposedly, of the angle polished connectors was to prevent reflections on cable. And again, unless you have bidirectional communication, which you do have sometimes nowadays, unless you have bidirectional communication, even then, I never understood exactly what the advantage was. With the angle polish connector, you would still get some kind of a dB loss from the interface. But again, since the reflection should go back towards the source, and the source should be ignoring any light on that frequency, I was never sure what the true advantage of an angle polish connector was. AC2IS.
Okay, thank you for that, Bill. I think I heard K2JAS. Is that true, Roger? Over to you, K2RIW.
Hey, K2RIW, K2JAS. Good evening, Dick. Good evening, everyone. Yes, that's me, and I'm just checking in and very interested in your conversation. Please continue. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Roger. Welcome aboard.
Say something else about Dick.
Yeah, Eric, I got a question for you. Is there reuse by way of horizontal and vertical polarization on the cable, clockwise and counterclockwise polarization? Are there any kinds of reuse like that? And I can see where they might not be because the uniformity of the cable is required to make sure you don't get cross-modulation between the two modes. Could be an extremely stringent requirement. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I am aware of some experiments done in that particular domain where they basically take the two lasers and they will pass through the polarizer, you know, polarize one horizontal and polarize one vertical. They don't necessarily come out that way. There are issues with it, and it's not that I'm aware of being used practically. It seems to be a lot of research going on in that. The consistency of how the molecules line up as you draw the glass is one of the things that they're trying to get better. And actually, they've been getting it better, and that's why the newer fibers have considerably less loss than some of the older stuff. So I think that's an ongoing area of experimentation that's continuing. I've kind of played with polarized laser lights years back when we used to do stuff in the laser lab, in the holographic lab. We used to have these big microflat, unbelievable tables to set things up on. That's a story for another day. K2IW, K2EJ.
So before we leave the subject of fiber optics cables, Andrew, with any further questions or comments before we pick up Rich, WB2GXM, if he's still with us. Andrew, with any further fiber questions before we leave the subject, give me a call, let us a name right now, K2LIW. Okay, we'll move on. Rich, if you're still with us, I hope we haven't put you to sleep. WB2GXM.
Don't forget my question.
Oh, yeah, I forgot W. How about that? K2EJ, go ahead, Eric.
I get the feeling this is going to be a bit of a discussion, so why not go to the next person first and we'll come back to it. It's about mixers and something that I've been playing with.
Yeah, mixers are real fun devices. WB2GXM, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Rich.
K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM. I'll make this short and sweet, and then you can commence with your discussion of mixers. I just wanted to wish you and everyone on the TechNet a very happy Father's Day. I hope you are having and have had a very good day. K2RIW, WB2GXM, Rich.
You've got the opportunity to ask a question if you want to, Rich.
No, I'm happy just to listen tonight. It's all very well and all very exciting and interesting. Carry on, WB2GX, I'm out.
Yeah, frequency reuse by way of clockwise and counterclockwise circular polarization. is being used on KU-band downlinks, DirecTV, direct satellite TV. And believe it or not, when you're watching your cable TV, when you're watching your satellite TV system, and a heavy rainstorm comes along, everybody thinks you get a fade out because of the insertion loss of the rainstorm. Almost never does that happen. The presence of the large water droplets in that downlink signal are slightly non-spherical objects that start mixing together the clockwise and counterclockwise signal. Just like the hams on 10 gigs can easily get a reflection off of a rain cloud because the individual water droplets are starting to approach a big enough fraction of a wavelength that they become significant radar cross-section objects. By the same token, the dropout you get is because the frequency reuse system of that KU-band downlink signal, the clockwise and counterclockwise signals start getting mixed together. They no longer have 25 or 30 dB of isolation between the two, and your converter says, I'm seeing two signals simultaneously. I can't figure out what's going on, and it gives you nothing. So that's the fade-out. It's really cross-polarization coupling more than insertion loss. And so you would have found that out by way of using a bigger dish, thinking that you're going to overcome the insertion loss of the rain. And that's not necessarily a good correction procedure because of this crazy phenomenon. KE2EJ with a question. K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
K2IW, K2EJ.
Well, if you happen to be lucky enough and there's nothing on the opposing transponder on the other polarization, you wonder why you can't get the other channels. That's funny. If you've got a good receiver and there's nothing on the other side, which is hard because actually you need two of the opposing transponders to be off because they don't line up perfectly with one another. Anyway, how much do you know about Gilbert cells?
I'm not sure, but I think a Gilbert cell, a little bit like a Bragg cell modulator. I think it's a kind of modulator, but here I'm not sure. Eric, go ahead.
I was hoping you were a little more into it, but okay. A Gilbert cell is essentially two differential amplifiers with two controllable current sources. In essence, it's a multiplier. You can use it as a mixer or a modulator. In my case, I decided that I was going to make one out of discrete components as opposed to use an NE602, which is, it's a receiver on a chip, but the mixer happens to be a Gilbert cell. It was developed and named after this guy Gilbert. I forget what his first name is. Anyway, it's a totally differential device, whereas that if you have two inputs which are differential, and they can be at any voltage, as long as the difference between the two pairs of differential amplifiers are the same, there's no output. So if one input goes in one direction, the opposing output goes in the other direction. Anyway, my question was going to be,
as I pass it over to you, I suddenly remembered a little bit more about what a Gilbert cell was, and I'm confusing it, but go ahead, Eric.
Okay. The NE602 has the six transistors really on the same substrate, on the same chip, so the thermal properties and the matching of the transistors is going to be really, really close. As opposed to my taking, say, 2N3904s, physically clamping the transistors together as one pair of differentials and clamping the other pair together as that pair of differential. And then the current sources, I haven't really decided whether I should thermally connect them to it or not. And the reason why I'm asking this is, first of all, those differential pair transistors really need to be matched. So that was my first little test because
when everything is balanced, you want to have zero voltage between the two differential outputs. And so, say, for example, I'm going to feed a carrier, and then I'm going to feed a sine wave of 1 kilohertz. I'm going to drop. Depending upon how I bias the current sources, I can either make it make double sideband modulation, or if I move it in one direction, I will have a lower sideband modulation. If I move it in the other direction, above whatever the quiescent, the half the power supply voltage is, I'm going to have upper sideband modulation. So I'm looking specifically for double sideband modulation. I notice firmly, if I even just put my finger on one pair of transistors, the carrier that should have been nulled out begins to creep back in it's really the transinductance to the transistor is changing. What are some of the ways that you can think of to try and minimize that? K2RW, K2J.
My experience may or may not help you. When I was building an exotic modulator using doubly balanced mixers, where I wanted to take a 10 gigahertz signal and I wanted to break it up into pulses that were a quarter of a nanosecond long, therefore each individual pulse consisted of 3 cycles of 10 gigahertz. And so I was using a doubly balanced mixer as a modulator. In other words, the RF was going into the local oscillator port. The RF is being taken out of the RF port, and I was using modulation on the IF port, because the IF port is DC coupled. And I found out that if I very, very carefully adjusted the voltage and or current on the DC port, the IF port, I could get an extremely good null of about 25 or so dB of the carrier being fed through when there was no modulation. And when everything was done just right, and because I needed a certain on-off ratio, I had to cascade a pair of mixers with padding in between and very careful mounting and a very careful timing. In other words, the length of the cable between the two mixers represented the so-called alligator problem. You want to make sure the alligator closes his jaws when the prey is going through, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So, in my case, I wasn't... By the way, when you put your finger on a transistor, you're adding a lot of capacitance with your finger, Eric, at the kind of frequencies you're working with. So, is your finger giving a...
No, if I just eat it.
Okay. You don't think your finger is adding straight capacitance, it's only adding heating. But I can think of various techniques by which you could build a servo mechanism to make sure you've got a very deep null as a function of warm-up. But if your drive signal is at the level that is not creating local heating, and if the substrate is mounted on a good plate of some kind that's being maintained at a constant temperature, what's the mechanism by which you might get this undesirable drift? And by the way, as you stop turning on and off different sides of this mixer-like network, you said you're going to get upper sideband or lower sideband. I think you really mean the positive half of the sine wave coming through or the negative half coming through when you're trying to get a null. That's what I think you're saying. I don't think it's as simple as upper or lower sideband. I mean, the kind of a image phasing mixer network required to get one sideband at a time, I don't think your simple mixer can possibly do all that, even though it is a Gilbert cell. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, if you want to go through the maps, it's pretty easy. Yeah, actually, you can get the, in essence, what you would call lower sideband if you're looking at it on a scope, or upper sideband. Depends upon where you bias the pair. You know, the pair, don't forget, we have two pairs that are operating differentially, so we're talking current modes for this whole thing. But if I change the bias on it through the constant current source, was that anything above the zero line of the incoming signal that's modulating the carrier, the transistor cuts off, it shuts off, so there's nothing upper coming through, and conversely,
if you move the bias in the other direction, you go beyond the point where the transistor is cut off, you're only left with the upper plate. If you do it right smack in the middle, you'll get double sideband modulation, no carrier, between where there should be no carrier.
It sounds like you desire double sideband suppressed carrier for the use that you're using this Gilbert cell mixer. And are you saying you have trouble maintaining that null so that the carrier is being suppressed? Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yeah, I'm saying I'm seeing the thermal effects of the individual transistors. I suppose, now that I'm thinking about it, if I put it in a, say, a temperature-controlled container, I could minimize that. I mean, the drift is really small, but it's enough to be problematic for what I'm trying to do, because I'm going to digitize this stuff.
How much carrier suppression are you looking for? More than 20 dB?
Minimum.
Yeah, but there's minimum and minimum. Your definition of minimum could be 10 dB down or 40 dB down, Eric, go ahead.
I'm relating to your 20 dB. It's a good number.
Yeah, I was with reasonable high-quality microwave doubly balanced mixers getting 20 or 25 dB of suppression per mixer was relatively easy to do.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, in essence, this thing is really a four quadrant multiplier. If I were to take, say, a 1495 or a 1496, one being differential, one being single ended, I'd do the same thing. It's all on the same hug of substrate, and I've used them in the past without any issues. I just decided I was going to build this out of discrete semiconductors, which was in itself a challenge, and it's a really simple circuit.
Sounds like you've got a nice project there, Eric. What is the final product going to do for you? What are you building?
Well, I've started writing some DSP codes because I wanted to do a couple things. And I require this double sideband without carrier to minimize the amount of data that I'm actually having to deal with. There's a bunch of things that I'm going to do with it in the end, but I got to get past this part to get to the next part.
Okay. I'm going to give a couple of words that I think I started last week or 2 weeks ago on the subject of reflection coefficient and standing wave ratio and the huge amount of misunderstanding there is among very well-educated people. The majority of us, in my opinion, have been victimized. We've been victimized by a very poor technique of teaching a basic principle. Once you memorize two or three very basic principles, an awful lot of the mystery of what's called standing wave ratio becomes a lot more understandable. Basic principle number one is that when a signal is propagating through a medium. That medium could be free space. The medium could be a transmission line. It could be a waveguide. But when a signal is propagating through a medium, you could say that signal is looking for no change in the characteristic impedance of the medium. If the medium doesn't change, if it's a thoroughly uniform piece of 50 ohm cable, if it's a thoroughly uniform piece of free space, the signal will go in direction, in one direction, only in one direction, never change direction. None of that signal will ever go back in the other direction, reverse its path, if you know what I mean. The signal will go in one direction if there's no change in the medium. That's a very important factor. It's not made very clear in the method by which we're taught what's going on in our transmission line. A 50 ohm cable terminated by a 50 ohm resistive antenna, all of the signal goes into the antenna, none of it reflects back. If there's any change in the
repeater, time out.
Let me drop. If there's any change in the characteristic impedance of the medium, It could be a cable where you've done something funny to the cable where it's got a bump. Somebody has dented the cable, so it's acting like you've got an extra capacitor in that area. We've got a change in the inner and outer diameter. If the resistive component or the reactive component of the impedance of the load or the cable changes, you're going to get a calculatable, quantifiable amount of reflection where that change took place. That light wave that's traveling through beautiful air and it suddenly hits the glass of the window on the front end of a store at a crazy angle, that's a huge change in the characteristic impedance of air versus glass, and you're going to get a reflection. And how much reflection is thoroughly predictable, and the phase angle of the reflection is thoroughly predictable once you know what was the change in the characteristic impedance of the medium. Let me drop. Once you've got a change in the medium, you're going to get a reflection. Some signal is now, for the first time, going to go back in the other direction. What phase angle it reflects at? I mean, if your 50 ohm antenna suddenly became a 25 ohm antenna, you're going to get a reflection, and the reflection is going to have 180 degrees of phase shift because the impedance was lower. If instead your 50 ohm antenna became a 100 ohm antenna, you're going to get a 0 degree angle of reflection because the impedance is higher. That's just the way higher and lower impedances decay. Higher impedance, you get a reflection in phase. Lower impedance, you're going to get a reflection out of phase. If it's a capacitive reflection, a capacitive load, you're going to get a leading phase angle of reflection. And if it's a inductive load, you're going to get a lagging phase angle of, you know, something between 0 and 180, 45 or 270 degrees, so to speak. And that's all predictable. Now, because of the change in the characteristic impedance that gave you a reflection, for the first time, you're going to get a signal propagating backwards in the other direction. Most people can sort of accept that, but the next step really bothers the hell out of them. The signal that's propagating backwards in the other direction has absolutely no interference with the signal that's propagating forward. The signal that's propagating forward is in the presence of a signal that's reflecting and propagating backwards. They do not mix. They do not see each other. A lot of people have a lot of trouble with that one. And so, because there's a reflection, they believe the forward-going signal is going to be changed in some way. It does not. The signals going from left to right in your cable and the signals going from right to left in your cable do not see each other. By the same token, in the room you're in right now, there are broadcast signals going from east to west, there are broadcast signals going from north to south, and all kinds of directions. Those two signals propagating through your room do not see each other. Absolutely no interaction, no interference. Let me drop. What's confusing about that is that when you're using a slotted line or a electrowire system, and you move that probe along the slotted line, at some particular place you see a peak where the two signals are in phase, at some other place a quarter of a wavelength away, you see a valley where the two signals are out of phase, and the peak-to-valley ratio, we call it standing wave ratio. You think, therefore, the two signals are mixing. They are mixing, but where are they mixing? They're mixing inside of your probe. Your probe has created a disturbance to the medium. And for the first time, the signal going from left to right gets mixed together, added together, with the signal going from right to left. And they mix together in your probe, and therefore, you see the fact that they're in phase and out of phase. But without your probe, that mixing action does not take place. There's a slight exception to that. Let me drop. When there's only one signal going down your cable, and every cable has got a finite amount of loss, and most of the loss is usually in the resistive component of the semiconductor, if you're using a high-quality dielectric material, it doesn't have its own loss tangent to it. So if you're using a high-quality material like Teflon, which has very little loss, the insertion loss of the cable, 3 dB per 100 feet, is mostly because of the resistive component in the center conductor. So when your main signal is going down the cable, your cable is a kind of a sine wave. At one instant of time, you could stop time and look at the voltage on the cable and for each inch you would see a slightly different voltage, slightly different polarity, and you trace it all out, and you would see a sine wave along the length of the cable at one instant of time. At a slightly greater instant of time, that whole Don sine wave, that whole waveform that you would draw, has all moved a little bit downrange. So that cable, that waveform is moving down the cable in time. Therefore, the amount of heating of the center conductor is uniform when there's only one signal. When you have two signals, one going left to right and one going right to left, there are certain places in the cable where the signal is usually in phase, the right to left and left to right signal in phase, and you get a little bit more heating in that case. And another place where they're out of phase, you get a little less heating. And so there are places where the voltages are in phase, there are places where the currents are in phase, and where the currents are in phase are the places where you get a little bit of heating. So now you get, for the first time, non-uniform heating of the cable because there are two signals. And again, you could be left to believe that the signal going left to right and right to left are somehow mixing together and interfering with each other. Absolutely not. Those two signals do not see each other. Let me drop. The main thing we all want to know about, whenever we have any mismatch in our system, a non-ideal antenna on the end of a transmission line, for instance, what we really care about most is how much reflection is taking place. If you got everything set up just right, no reflection takes place, all the power that your cable is capable of delivering to the antenna gets delivered to the antenna, and hopefully all of it gets radiated. So reflection coefficient is the main thing we care about. If 10% of the power is reflecting, because you've got roughly a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna, you've got a 100-ohm antenna on a 50-ohm cable, roughly 10% of the power is going to be reflected. You don't care so much about the fact that 10% got reflected. What you care about is that the 10% of the reflection must obey conservation of energy, therefore only 90% of the energy went forward, and you lost 10% of that energy. And for the average person, 10% loss is half a dB of loss, and that's not beyond the threshold of alarm. When it starts becoming a third of the power or half the power being lost, now you really get alarmed. So reflection coefficient or transmission coefficient is the main thing we care about. Let me drop. That's the real message. And nowadays, all the instrumentation we use usually consists of a standing wave ratio bridge or a directional coupler, which have very strong similarity. In either case, our standing wave ratio bridge or our directional coupler tells you what is the percentage of power going forward and the percentage of power being reflected. It gives you the main information that you want. That's the real message. Back in the days when you didn't have a directional coupler, in the early 1920s, they hadn't discovered directional couplers yet. Let me drop. So by way of your slotted line or your electrowire system, you made the indirect measurement. You knew because there's going to be a signal going forward, and if the system is imperfect, there's going to be a signal reflected back, and at certain places along that transmission line, the signals are in phase, you're going to see a peak in voltage, and other places you're going to see a valley in voltage. You measured the standing wave ratio. That was the indirect measurement, which with some mathematics allows you to calculate what percentage is going forward and what percentage is reflecting back. That's the real message you want. But we made the indirect measurement because that's the only instrumentation you had in those days. All of a sudden, the standing wave ratio, the indirect measurement, became the standard. That's the coded message. With your directional coupler, you directly measure forward power and reverse power. That's what you really want to know. And why bother encoding it with this thing? Take the forward power and the reverse power, take the ratio of the two, take the square root of that, call it rho, 1 plus rho divided by 1 minus rho. That gives you standing wave ratio. We start encoding the message for traditional reasons. That's crazy. But now, because of this misunderstanding, because of the victimization we've all gone through, where we learn standing wave ratio primarily mathematically, as opposed to understanding the main basic principle. Let me drop this. The main basic principle number one is any change in the characteristic impedance of the medium usually transmission line, is going to create a reflection. Once you know the amount of change in the impedance of the medium, you know the magnitude of the reflection and the polarity of the reflection, so you know the phase angle, if you know what I mean. And number three, the signal going forward and the signal coming back have no interference with each other. People think that they interfere with each other. As such, there's a whole lot of people who say you can't use a Bird watt meter if the system is not flat, because you can't believe the forward power and reverse power anymore. Absolutely not true. If the system is always, if a Bird watt meter can only be used in a system that's perfect, then why bother using a Bird watt meter? The whole reason for the Bird watt meter is to measure the amount of power going forward and the amount of power coming back. And even though the system is poorly matched, it's giving you a real good piece of information. If you know how to interpret it, it's telling you a basic truth. There is nothing in the instruction manual of the Bird watt meter telling you that it doesn't work correctly in a non-flat system. You'd be amazed how many people believe that. Now, where it becomes a little bit confusing is that when you're using an antenna tuner, let me drop. When the antenna tuner is set up just right, it is taking all of the reflected power, re-reflecting it forward, not only creating a perfect impedance match for the transmitter at that end of the cable, but it's taking all of the power reflected back from the antenna, re-reflecting it forward, in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter right now. As such, because a certain amount of power is now bouncing back and forth between the mismatched device and the antenna tuner, some of the power is not being radiated directly, bouncing a few times before it finally gets radiated, you could take a 100-watt transmitter with a, let me pick a number, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna and a low-loss transmission line. You might see 115 watts going forward you might see 115 watts going forward on the output end of the antenna tuner, even though the input end of the antenna tuner shows exactly 100 watts and nothing reflected. That's what the transmitter is saying. The fact that you see greater amounts of power is not violation of any laws of physics. That's the extra power that's bouncing back and forth. The antenna is only radiating at 90% of the power. Therefore, if the feed line was low enough and lost, the forward power has to be 10% higher in order to compensate. If your feed line is very low and lost, your antenna tuner is very high in efficiency, you could have 10% reflected power, 110% power going forward, 100% power radiated, 100% power coming out of the transmitter. The fact that you see 110 watts going forward is not something to call it, hey, that's only reactive power. It's real. You could take a sample of that and light a light bulb with it. It's real power. So these formulas that we learn as a method of learning standing wave ratio situations, mismatch situations, have led us to believe that the forward going
repeater, time out.
They've led us to believe that the forward going signal and the reverse going signal mix together in the cable and do funny things to each other. They don't. They don't see each other. And so, once you've got this basic information, an awful lot of the mystery of what's going on makes some sense. The reason this came about in my thinking is because the June issue of QST Magazine in the Doctor Is In section had a prediction of the extra insertion loss that takes place because of a splice that was put in the cable. And because of a misunderstanding of what's really going on with the reflected signal situation, you're led to believe by that article that no matter where in the cable is the splice, it's going to create a predictable amount of loss, and the loss is identical no matter where the splice is located. That's not true. If you're foolish enough to put the splicing device that creates some extra standing wave ratio, if you put it directly at the output of the antenna tuner, at the bottom end of the cable, there would be no extra loss, because there's now some signal bouncing back and forth between the splice and the antenna tuner, and there's only an inch of cable between the two, and there's no extra loss in that situation. Whereas if you put the splice way up at the top of the cable at the antenna, now you're going to get extra loss along the whole length of the cable. There's now signals bouncing back and forth on the whole length of the cable. The extra signal bouncing back and forth means that that signal doing the bouncing is experiencing the insertion loss of the cable multiple times. That's where the extra loss comes from. Now, you would get the full loss of the splice creating its standing wave ratio. When is it the power end of the cable? Let me drop. My point is no well-informed VHF amateur would put a splice in the cable way up at the antenna. In other words, that's the worst place to do it. If he's got 100 feet to overcome between his transmitter and the antenna, he's got a pair of 50-ohm cables. He's got to put a splice in. He's got a pair of cables that are each 50 feet long, each 50 ohms, and he's going to put a splice in the middle, and he's going to make the splice out of a PL-259 connectors, which, by the way, have about a 30-ohm apiece. That's the reason they create some standing wave ratio. If you put the splice in the middle of the cable, only the lower half of the cable would have the extra insertion loss, because that's the only place where a bouncing signal is taking place. If it created a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, where 10% of the power is reflected and only 90% goes forward, of that 90% of power that goes forward that's finally launched into the upper half of the cable, that cable has no reflected signal on it, because any signal on that cable sees the 50-ohm antenna and all that gets radiated. There's no extra loss in that half of the cable. There are people who believe, the majority of people who believe, that a standing wave ratio in any position along a cable is going to create extra insertion loss along the whole length of the cable. That's not true. So there's a very basic reflected signal characteristic, standing wave ratio characteristic, that are highly misunderstood. And if the right way to teach new material, in my opinion, let me drop it, is to explain the basic theory of operation of the system so that the new student gets a mental image of what's taking place. And once he's got that mental image, then you give him the mathematics that goes along with it so he can quantify it. But if a person could see the fact that a signal propagating in a uniform medium has no reflection, and only you're going to get a reflection at the position where you've created a change in the impedance of the medium, at that point you're going to get a reflection. And that reflection is going to take from that place back down toward the transmitter. The rest of the cable has no additional detriment, no additional standing wave ratio, no additional loss. The rest of the cable doesn't know what happened. So maybe this helps some. As I said, we've all learned standing wave ratio by a mathematical process. But if you're using a directional coupler, if you're using a Berg wattmeter, and you can measure forward power and reverse power, you can stop right there. That's the main piece of information you want to know. What percentage of my power is being reflected? What percentage, therefore, by the laws of conservation of energy, does not get a chance to go forward on the first pass? And if I was not using an antenna tuner, how much grief is my transmitter going to experience? Let me drop. For traditional reasons, we've learned something called standing wave ratio, which is an indirect measurement that used to be measured on lecture wires or a slotted line. We keep taking forward and reverse power measured with the Berg wattmeter, going to a lookup chart or a mathematical table, and converting it to standing wave ratio. That's the coded message. It's time we stop encoding the message. Our modern-day instrumentation measures the thing we want to know directly. Okay. Time for space report. Paul WS2N. About to give us space report number 255 of the series. What's NASA and all those other space geniuses doing this week, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. This is WS2N. And, oh yeah, there's always something going on, I'm sure, but for instance, there's a launch tomorrow by SpaceX from Launch Complex 39A, and they're going to be launching a Bulgarian satellite, so that should be pretty good. This is another one of these reused boosters that are going up. I think I mentioned last week it was originally launched in January for the Iridium program. It launched it out of Vandenberg.